The central figure upon whom we focus tonight is Genghis Khan. Our two guests are close students of the life of Genghis Khan, and they're looking for his tomb. They are Maury Kravitz, a Chicago lawyer and businessman who is the leader of the Genghis Khan expedition dedicated to finding that tomb, and John Woods, who's an old friend of ours and has been on this program many times in the past, indeed a colleague from the University of Chicago, where he is professor of Iranian and Central Asian history. And he is the academic advisor and the academic activist on the Genghis Khan expedition. Gentlemen, before you get a chance to say a word, I want to read something to you from testimony given by a young, recently discharged lieutenant from the Vietnam War named John Kerry, when he appeared on April 22, 1971, before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. And he's telling them about testimony recently given at a meeting in Detroit by veterans of the Vietnam War. And he says, they told stories that at times they had personally raped, cut off ears, cut off heads, taped wires from portable telephones to human genitals and turned up the power, cut off limbs, blown up bodies, randomly shot at civilians, razed villages in a fashion reminiscent of Genghis Khan, shot cattle and dogs for fun, poisoned food stocks, and generally ravaged the countryside of South Vietnam. So the reference for the horrors of war and the excesses of the conqueror, the reference is Genghis Khan. Does he deserve that, John?
Well, I mean, he may deserve it in the sense that Alexander the Great would deserve the same kind of, and there's tremendous interest in Alexander the Great these days, and I think people who've seen the film realize that there was a tremendous amount of bloodshed. There is any time there's conquest, and figures like Attila the Hun and Genghis Khan and Tamerlane and people have been singled out as examples of the kind of scourges of civilization that people love to dwell on ad infinitum, and Genghis Khan is one of those people that people like to do that with.
It's even in Russian opera. In Boris Godunov, in the first act, a fellow sits on a stone railing and sings of the horrors of the Mongol invasion.
Well, I'm afraid I wouldn't entirely agree with my close associate, John Woods, here. The opinion of John Kerry that you read, as well as conjoined with the typical opinions of the Western world on the man, on the individual Genghis Khan. I don't like to talk about Attila the Hun and some of the other Eastern world despots, but I know Genghis Khan, I understand him, and he's been given a very bad rap for the things that he has been given credit for. This is based upon the ignorance in the Western world of anything about him.
Well, Maury, isn't it true that when they came in, when they captured certain cities, particularly in their drive westward in Russia, in what is now Kazakhstan and so on, and on even further to the west in Europe, that they razed whole cities and killed all the occupants?
Yes, but there were many cities they did not raze and they did not kill the occupants, but instead set up a very small garrison of Mongolian troops with a governor and left the people rule themselves.
So when did they decide to wipe out the town?
They did when people resisted the invasion by the Mongols. But had the people cooperated with the Mongol administration, the Mongols would see fit that they were left alone and they would thrive, in fact. Some of them were better off after the Mongols took administration over them.
So the Mongols, John Woods, were kind of pleasant conquerors who really intended to bring the equivalent of the Pax Romana. This was
Conquest
Mongola.
Pax Mongolica.
Mongolica.
Conquest has never been pleasant by anybody, whether it's by Romans or by anybody else. Let's face it.
Let's look at the extent of the conquest. When does it it is begun by Genghis Khan.
It is indeed, and of course, when you mention people moving into Russia, that's not in the time of Genghis Khan. That's in the time of his descendants.
Mm-hmm.
Genghis Khan actually conquers much of northern China, or begins the conquest of much of northern China, and some of the eastern part of the Islamic world by the time he dies. It's his...
His dates are 1167 or 62, it's argued.
Mongolians like to choose 1162.
And he dies in 1227.
That's pretty definite.
August of 1227.
Yes, indeed.
That's fairly definite.
So he lives about 60 or 65 years.
Something like that, yeah.
And in that time, he conquers all of what is now modern China, just about.
Not all of modern China, but
northern
most
China.
Of northern China.
Yeah.
And most of what would be Central Asia and part of the Eastern Iran today.
Central Asia. By present geographic designation, that would be which
country? That would be the countries of presently of Afghanistan, Iran, northern Iran, mm-hmm. Iraq, and all the areas that are currently inhabited by the new stands. Tajikistan,
exactly.
Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan, exactly. So that's, these areas.
That's a fair amount of accomplishment for a life lived out in 65 years.
Yes, indeed it is. And I mean, the fact that he did conquer so much territory, that was much of the known world at that time. His descendants, mm-hmm. however, though, go on to conquer other parts of the mm-hmm. the known world, including most of the eastern part of the Middle East, including Iran, Iraq, and so on, parts of Turkey, parts of Russia, all of China. They try to invade Japan on two different occasions. They invade Burma. There's an expedition to Java. This is a very far-flung set of...
And going further west, they seem to get as far as contemporary Romania, Bulgaria, Hungary.
As far as the city of Budapest.
As far as Budapest.
Yes, the cities of Budapest and marching down, actually, they got as far as marching down the Adriatic coast mm-hmm. into what is now, we all know, Bosnia-Herzegovina, mm-hmm. the old... stomping grounds of the present problems in that area.
Now, all of this seems rather miraculous because these were just a few itinerant nomadic types from Mongolia who rode small horses and were nomadic people when they were first pulled together as a great raiding force by Genghis Khan.
And what's amazing about that very factor, Milton, is that the Mongol soldiers were not trained as soldiers as such.
They were herdsmen, I guess.
They were herdsmen. Yeah. They were armed as they had been in the field and as nomadic horsemen. They had not been trained other than knowing how to follow orders.
So what explains their tremendous historical achievement, whether you like it or don't, whether it was rapacious or somehow heroic? What explains their ability in 100 years or so to establish this vast empire?
Well, there was some training involved, and I would say, Moraine, you may disagree with me, but I would say that there is some issue of the hunt is a training exercise.
Okay, if you want to call the hunt a training exercise.
The semi-annual migrations are also a training exercise in which people have got to organize themselves in order to do these things. I think most importantly, and maybe Moraine will support this, was the fact that Genghis Khan was a genius at social engineering. And I maintain this particular point, that one of his greatest achievements was as a social engineer in re-engineering the tribal structure of the people.
As well as being a military genius. Mm. He is the one that introduced into Central Asia the decimeter system, dividing his military forces into squads, platoons, similar to the structure of the American Army today or the Russian Army today. 10 platoons into a company into a regiment into a battle corps into a division, division into an army.
But when he went against the people he wanted to conquer, he was usually outnumbered by 2 or 3 to 1.
Always outnumbered, in fact, in almost all of
his battles.
How did
they do so well when they were so small a force?
Well, they were incredibly well organized. They had an intelligence system that did not belong in Central Asia, but Genghis Khan's genius implemented it.
They had an early version of the CIA.
It was very much so, because he never went into a full battle without scouting out the enemy uh-huh. first, even to the extent of knowing whether the sultan of the next city that he was going to invade was on good terms with his relatives. He got that sophisticated. But his military tactics, which are second to none and which are still studied at West Point, at Saint-Cyr, at Sandhurst in England, and were the great studying grounds of a guy named George Patton, as well as the Desert Fox, all study Genghis Khan tactics, cavalry tactics, and apply them to the panzers or to the tank maneuvers. This man's military genius stands unrivaled at this point.
In the great poem, in Kublai Khan...
In Xanadu,
did Kublai Khan a stately pleasure dome decree, where out the sacred river ran, down caverns,
measureless to man, down to a
sunless sea. That's the great Coleridge poem.
Exactly.
Kublai Khan is related to Genghis Khan how?
He's his grandson.
He's the grandson. So that points to the dynastic aspect.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
How long did the dynasty continue?
It depends on what part of the world you're talking about. In China, of course, they formed the Yuan dynasty, which lasts until the second half of the 14th century. In Russia, there are Genghis Khan is ruling as late as the middle of the 19th century in Kazakhstan. In Iran,
the 19th century.
That is
form?
Correct. In Kazakhstan, as Khans of various Kazakh hordes in that area. In Iran, the dynasty begins to sort of peter out about the first half of the 14th century.
Will the Abbasids take over?
Oh, no, the Abbasids are long since gone.
They're gone. They conquered the Abbasids.
They end the Abbasids,
and actually, even to the extent of northern India, where you've heard the term, the great Mughal Empire.
Yes, indeed.
Of India. Yeah. Well, the word Mughal is nothing more than a word meant for Mongol. By the way, it's one of the two words that I know that has come down to English from the Mongolian.
Mm-hmm.
The word Mughal, which we use as a colloquialism, and the other word is horde, which comes from the Mongol word ordu, which means what it is, a horde of people.
Mm-hmm.
The Mongol Empire lasted, as my friend John has mentioned here, a long time in various places. It did not disintegrate completely and totally in one shot. It took many hundreds of years before it
And do we it. Then, in some of the reaches of their extension to the west, do we have, in fact, descendants of the Mongols making up the basic population?
We have descendants. I have descendants of my own family. My wife has 9 aunts who, if you looked at them, you would see in their skull structure, the facial structure, mm-hmm. the Mongol features, the high cheekbones, the aquiline eyes, because the relationship between the Mongols and Russians was very intimate.
Which Russians?
With the modern-day Russians in the heart of Russia.
Is your wife Jewish?
My wife is Jewish.
And are you talking then about Mongol
influence and intervention along involved with Jewish people? Yes.
But the Jews of the Pale are supposedly descended from immigrants from France and Germany in the 13th century.
I'm afraid that during the Mongol period, a lot of these Jews got involved with Mongol boyfriends.
Uh-huh.
Okay, that's the best way I could put it.
Uh-huh. Well, we've got a whole group of people called the Lithuanian Tatars, which still exist now in Lithuania today, who do preserve many, many, many of these northern Asiatic features that we associate with Mongolia.
And John, we were talking just before we went on the air about a study only recently released in which they're tracing by DNA methodology descendants of Genghis Khan and his family.
Oh, yes, indeed. I mean, they're claiming that a certain very, very high proportion of the present population of East Asia is somehow intimately related to Genghis Khan. I don't know how they know this exactly, because we haven't found Genghis Khan yet to know what his DNA
you know
is.
You have to have his DNA to do that.
In a way,
exactly.
That's true. So,
but you guys may ultimately solve that problem when you find the bones of Genghis Khan.
We hope so.
We will now talk, after some coming commercials, about your search for the tomb of Genghis Khan, which has been underway now for some 5 or 6 years at least.
Yes.
An expedition essentially led by Maury Kravitz and John Woods, who are with us tonight, and we'll look at the history of that great search and discover just where it stands at the moment after we pause for this. And we return to John Woods and Maury Kravitz. John Woods is a well-established and major academic. He's been on this program many times in the past. Particularly as we looked at Iran, when Iran was up for grabs, and he being a major student of Iranian history and politics and so on. But he's also much involved in the studies of Central Asian civilizations. And that's how we got involved with Maury Kravitz. But now, I've got a special assignment for you, John. Tell the world something about Maury Kravitz.
Well, Maury Kravitz was a person who I was aware of the fact that things had been written about him, and he had this kind of cockamamie idea about Genghis Khan and one thing and another, and I was amused by the whole thing, but I was never so amused as when I got a call from him asking me whether I'd like to be involved in this search for something that sounded like a needle in a haystack in a huge country twice the size of my own home state of Texas. And I hemmed and hawed and said, "Well, are you interested?" And I said, "You bet your boots I am. My CV is in the mail." So it took me about 5 seconds to decide that this was really a very important thing to be involved in, and that what this man was doing was extremely important, and that the energy behind it was very important.
Maury, you, in life, until you got focused obsessively on searching for the tomb of Genghis
Obsessive
Khan.
Obsessive is the right word.
Obviously it is. I've been looking at some of the materials and stories about you. But you have been, you're a lawyer by training.
Yes,
and you were in law practice. Then you became a major operator at the commodities exchange.
Yes,
the mercantile
exchange. I spent 35 years there.
And you're a big gold trader.
Yes, I was.
And you made a fair amount of money, one gathers.
I did.
I won't ask you how much. But how did, with that background, did you come to get so obsessed about the need to find the tomb, still undiscovered, of Genghis Khan?
Well, you know, you would think that there's going to be some wonderful, large answer to this that's mm-hmm. going to be very romantic and so forth. However, the truth of the matter is that many years ago, 45 years ago, about, I was given a book by a friend to read, and it was the first book I had ever come in contact with about Genghis Khan. It was called Genghis Khan, Emperor of All Men.
By Harold Lamm.
By Harold Lamm. Yeah. A wonderfully written book. Not a very heavily, very much of a scholarly book, but a wonderfully written book. And it set me on my heels. I could not believe that a man, illiterate, could come out of the steppes of Central Asia, conquer half the world, implement a written language for a people that were illiterate, implement a communication system that was 6,000 miles long and defied description and its effect, and was totally anti-bigot, would not let any bigotry come into his regime. Everybody could practice their religions as he saw fit. Where did such, and was a military genius to begin with? That required me to go hunting for more things about Genghis Khan. And I did. And I prowled the bookstores, and I went to used bookstores, and I went to bookstores outside of Chicago, chasing for materials, hungry for it. The obsession grew, and until 1987, it remained an academic pursuit. But in 1987, something happened to change my course with reference to Genghis Khan.
I think this is the moment where my cue is, well, what happened?
Good. Good question. What happened is late one night, I came across an old archive that mentioned that at a certain point in the youth of Genghis Khan, when he was about to go into battle, this was before he had earned the name Genghis Khan, he was still Temujin of the Mongol tribe. And
Genghis Khan, by the way, in translation means what?
Well, it means greatest ruler or oceanic ruler. Believe it or not, there's no ocean in Mongolia, but oceanic ruler.
It means universal ruler.
Yeah. And and by the way, it's not pronounced correctly when we say Genghis or
it's
Genghis.
Genghis.
It's like China. Chinggis.
Chinggis.
Chinggis. At any rate, going back to that, in this little archival discovery, it suggested that if you found the interchange, the crossing over of two particular rivers by name, and if you looked over your right shoulder, you would see a mountain, and that mountain would be called the Burkhan Khaldun, the mountain most favored to contain the tomb of Genghis Khan.
Now, what was the source? What were you reading?
It was an old book, an archival book. I couldn't even give you the author even now. But it's mentioned three separate times in three old books.
There's a great, a major book titled The Secret History of the Mongols. That's not the book you found.
No. Secret History of the Mongols is the only Mongolian-originated text.
Back to the 13th century.
Yeah, that gives a lineage of the of Genghis Khan, his family, and so forth. It's the most important writing. And I'm sure my friend John can tell you a lot more about the secret history. It's a very important document, and it leads us down various information trails that are being studied even today. It's a instrument that has not fully been laid out completely yet.
But you found in some other obscure source
a reference.
A reference sort of pointing to a location of the tomb.
Yes. And I said to myself, if I can find these two rivers, if I can identify where they are, if I can find where they cross over and I could see that mountain over my right shoulder. I've got a shot at finding the tomb.
What are the names of those rivers?
Well, I hesitate to mention them right now. I don't want a lot of people in this world making reservations going to Mongolia to find those
But as I rivers. Understand it, when you go to the maps, those two rivers don't appear.
They appear in a different way, by a different name. One of the rivers appears as actually named. The other river has several different names, and that's as much as I'm going to say about it.
All right. But as I understand it further, because I've been reading some material in preparation for tonight, there have been many other expeditions searching for the tomb over recent years, and they've had other hypotheses as to where the tomb might be located.
Yes, indeed they have, and many of the Mongolists of the world, the people who spend all their lives studying the Mongols, opt for this mountain called Burhan Khaldun. But the problem with this is that there is no single mountain that is universally recognized as being this Burhan Khaldun.
How does Burhan Khaldun translate? What does it
Something
mean?
Like the mountain of the Buddha.
And there are people with a Burhan Khaldun.
Also I think at last count there were something like 17.
17 is
17
the right
mountains.
There's 17 of them.
That doesn't help, does it?
No, it does not. And so that's one thing. And we don't know whether it's a single mountain or whether it's a group of mountains. Uh-huh. We're not sure about this. So there's a lot of modern Mongolians and some Mongolian scholars have settled on a single peak, which is it's a sizable mountain. It's about 8,000, it's over 8,000 feet high, and it's well known. The president of Mongolia actually goes there to worship now. So it's a well-known spot, and many people believe that particular
and
spot.
And it's more well-known by the fact that my friend John Woods, sitting next to me, will try to go up that mountain on a horse. The horse took one look at the top of the mountain and gave up. The horse went down, Woods went down. Tumbling down the side of the mountain.
But now, is that the Burhan Khaldun that you've settled for?
Not exactly, because we're not entirely sure, again, whether it refers to a single mountain or a group of mountains, or whether it's that mountain or another mountain. We're not entirely sure about this. But it's the place that many people focus on as the likely place where he's buried.
Well, now, of course, I've been reading about your more or less conviction. The two of you share it, I gather. That a particular location that you have found, which is walled in a sort of a circular way, is a grave site where many are buried, quite possibly also that's where Genghis Khan is buried. Is that grave site on or near this particular mountain?
It is not very near it, but it's in a group of mountains where we know that Genghis Khan was very active. He was active in this whole region that we've been working in. And this probably, the place we're working now, is probably the only walled gravesite that I know of in Central Asia.
And it is a spectacular thing to see, Milt. We have now confirmed, although we didn't know it the first time we saw it, we now know that it is a graveyard.
What's the name of the place?
The Olgochin Kerem.
Say that again.
Olgochin Kerem.
I don't know how to write that. How do you spell that?
Can you spell it?
It's hard to spell.
O-G- L-O-G,
Oglogchin Kerem.
C-H-I-N Kerem, K-H-E-R-E-M.
The Oglogchin Kerem.
Kerem.
We pause for some commercials. When we come back, we'll zero in on the Oglogchin Kerem, because you've been digging there, I know.
Yes.
In recent excavations, and we need to find out what you've dug up. Directly back to John Woods and Maury Kravitz, the two main people in the great new and continuing expedition to unearth ultimately the bones and possibly the treasure of Genghis Khan. We return after this. We are on the search for Genghis Khan. I will persist in the Western pronunciation with Maury Kravitz and John Woods, who have been on the search for his tomb in Mongolia. And we've now specified the site. Oglachin, if I say it correctly, Khmer? Or say it again.
The Oglochin Kerem.
Kerem. The Oglochin Kerem. I didn't read my own writing correctly. So you've been there, and describe the place.
Well, it's quite an amazing site. It's a walled enclosure, 2 miles in circumference. The wall ranges in height between 8 to 12 feet. It's on the side of a fairly high high hill that slopes up about probably about 800 feet from the
this
lower
part. This is a few hundred miles northeast.
It's about 200 miles northeast of the capital.
Ulaanbaatar,
yeah.
Yeah.
And as far as I know, it's the only wall structure like that in Mongolia. As we began to investigate it, we discovered, in fact, that there are people buried inside this area, and there are a number of structures that we think are ritual structures that were designed for worship of some kind or another.
What do we know about the dating of that wall that surrounds the area?
We don't know anything about it just yet. I mean, we have found some burials inside the wall that are much earlier than the Mongol period, and we found a burial inside the wall
that dates from
the Mongol period.
Yes.
So it was something that was used for a very long period of time.
It predates Genghis Khan.
In terms of use, its use predated Genghis
yeah.
Khan, but it was used also after the time of Genghis Khan as well.
And you have yourselves dug up a number of graves there, haven't
we
you?
We have liberated some very nice skeletons, very intact.
Yeah.
One of our finer lads in the ground was in a tree trunk, a carved-out tree trunk, and laid in the soil.
Well, who are they? What can you tell about the people whose graves you've unearthed?
We don't know who they are.
Can you date them?
We did carbon test several of them, and they did carbon test in the imperial period. That's the Genghis Khan period.
Mm-hmm.
So
that's promising, isn't it?
Very promising. And the fact that the area is so large, no, it's a larger 2 miles in circumference. My God, that can hold thousands of burials.
Do you have any way of estimating how many graves are there?
There's no way, in my opinion, that you can estimate it. But I'll tell you, part of the intriguing part is that most of our diggings have taken place in the lower echelon, in the lower area of the Karam Wall area.
Mm.
We have not done any serious excavating in the higher areas yet.
Higher up on the mountain?
Exactly. And
if you're going to bury somebody like Genghis Khan, it should be higher rather than lower.
It would be at the higher level,
yeah.
Yes.
Huh.
So we're hopeful that, but as John Woods just mentioned, this is a needle in a haystack hunt. It's a search. And when you think that we are searching for somebody that lived 800 years ago, when they're doing digging in Egypt for 3,000 and 4,000 and 5,000 years ago, the difficulty is the tomb culture of Egypt as compared to the, to the tomb culture.
Now, what do we have from the relevant scholars? I know that there are some Mongolists, I believe they're called, in the Western world. There are also lots of Mongolists in Mongolia. And you've got some archaeological colleagues in the National Academy of Mongolia. Are they pretty well convinced that this is where the tomb of Genghis Khan will be found?
I wouldn't say that the Mongolists in Mongolia are necessarily convinced of that. I would say that the European and foreign Mongolists tend to focus on the mountain which is now called Burhan Khaldun.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it is, in fact, the Burhan Khaldun or not, we don't know. Inside Mongolia, there's a great variety of opinion about this. Although, as I said before, the president of Mongolia still worships at this one site. Our people associated with our expedition, in our expedition alone, there are many, many differences of opinion about where we should be looking and where we should be searching. And we've narrowed it down to 3 or 4 spots, including the spot that we're talking about.
3 or 4 separate sites.
That's right.
Oh, so the others are elsewhere.
They're elsewhere. But they're in the same province. We're working all within one province. And Mongolia is divided into 22 different provinces. And one of them is thought to be literally Genghis Khan's stomping ground. I mean, this is where
the home territory.
Yeah, he might have been born there. He grew up. That's where many important events in his life took place until he began his career of conquest.
His career of conquest involved a vast amount of wealth that he gathered unto himself from all the places that he conquered. And as far as I understand it from what I've been reading lately, none of his take has been recovered.
This is absolutely true.
So and maybe a lot of it is buried with him.
We know, archivally speaking, that from around 1216, 1217, right down through the very end, 1227, that he rolled back into the motherland, these huge carts laden with spoils of war.
Gold, what kinds of spoils would that have been?
Oh, my God, the size would have defied the imagination.
A lot of gold.
He took, he pillaged and looted from some of the greatest cultures, Samarkand, Bukhara, Tashkent, great cultural cities and so forth, wealthy places. And all of it flowed back to Mongolia, artifacts of all kinds. And the most interesting factor is not that none of it has been found at this point, but that not one piece has been found. A single dagger, not a jewel
sword. In all of
sword.
Mongolia they have found.
Well, I don't know of any museum that has any one of these precious things, and I don't know of a private collection that has them. Is my considered opinion, John may not agree with me. I think all of it went in the ground with the old man.
But that would be a vast amount to bury.
Needing a large burial party.
Very
right?
Large, I would think.
A couple
indeed,
thousand.
Indeed. I mean, you know, what Maury says is quite true. One of the difficulties that we labor under is the fact that no imperial Mongol tomb has ever been found. And that includes the tomb of Kublai Khan and the other great rulers of the Mongol Empire. So we don't know what to expect.
Hey, John, wouldn't it be likely that wherever Genghis Khan is buried, some of his successors would also be buried?
Well, that's one of the theories, one of the traditions that goes along with it, and it's certainly there's a statement that Kublai Khan is buried with Genghis Khan.
Yes.
Mongolians believe that all 34 rulers of Mongolia
are buried
together.
So that if we found one, both John and I agree on this point.
This would really be the Golden Horde.
Yeah, it would be very good. It would be a major Golden Horde, and we'd get the whole pile together.
Uh-huh.
One of the greatest archaeological discoveries of all times. Look out, Mr. Carter and Mr. Heinrich Schliemann of Troy.
That's Troy, and Carter is Tutankhamun.
Tutankhamun.
But you are pledged to the Mongolian government to touch, not to grab for yourself, not a single jewel dagger.
Not one single piece of any wealth.
It all belongs to Mongolia.
Yes.
Yes.
Belongs to the Mongolian people. We want nothing of it. Only the joy of being involved in the discovery.
What if you don't find it? Obviously, your life has been focused on this for some time, Maury.
We're getting older, both John and I.
Mm-hmm.
And we just hope that we're going to be lucky enough to live long enough to have the wherewithal to continue our search and to make it a successful one. Look, the way I feel about it, it is a needle in the haystack, only I feel that we really have identified the haystacks. We need to find the needle now.
But are you more convinced that you've got the right location than John is? How do the two of you, do you converge in your judgments, or is there some friendly argument between you?
We play different roles, I would say.
Your role, John?
My role is to be the skeptical scholar, and I've got to.
And he does a good job of it.
And I've got to be measured, and I've got to be very careful about what I say. Maury is more of a showman, and
Maury's the enthusiast.
Well, I'm not unenthusiastic myself, but I have to be more careful about what I say.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that we're very close. I think that the Karam Wall area is a tremendously potential resting place for these Khans. It's big enough. There isn't another place like it in all of Central Asia. It is a burial ground. It's a natural place for them to be resting.
Let me understand the methodology. If you go back there this summer, as I know you're trying to get the supporting funds so you can mount the next phase in the expedition, what do you do once you get back there? How do you dig? What's the nature of
We continue
the
working in the site that we've been working at, because I believe, as Maury does, I think it's a very, very important site. Regardless of what may or may not be buried there, mm-hmm. I think the site we're at now is extremely important. There are two other sites that I would really like to investigate that are feasible right now. Let's say if we get a certain amount of funding, that are feasible sites to investigate. And some of those come from my own inclination, and some come from guidance that I've received from my Mongolian colleagues. And I believe that we should try to investigate those also, or at least begin the process.
Now, how do you go about it? I'm very interested in the archaeological method here. If you go back to the mountain that we've been talking about, where apparently there are hundreds, maybe thousands of grave sites, how do you decide where to dig? And then how do you go about the digging itself? What's the method of recovery? and analysis of the finds.
Most of this is done now by our Mongolian colleagues, and they've already elaborated quite an extensive approach to dealing with these kinds of graves and these kinds of sites. So we pretty much leave it to them.
They've done this before elsewhere
in
Mongolia.
Oh, yes, they have. So and there are all sorts of reasons for this. There's the whole issue of the sensitivity. I mean, remember that Genghis Khan is something like a combination, I always like to put it, a combination of Jesus Christ and George Washington. I mean, he is the father and the spiritual backer, the spiritual support of the
whole
nation.
And he must be on their stamps and money.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
And John's point is very important because the shamanistic background of the people of Mongolia is such that many of the people are disturbed when they hear that somebody's trying to dig up their great forefathers.
I gather a former prime minister, or was he a former president, has condemned what you're doing.
Well, he came out to visit us.
He did. Yeah.
He visited our site and pointed his finger. He told us to get out. And our chief archaeologist, as well as John Wood, said, no, we are not getting out. You go back, do what you want to do. We're staying right here, and we're going to continue digging. So we've had some ordeals. Not to mention the snakes in the wall. The wall seems to have some inhabitants. They've been there a long time. They're a rather venomous viper that lives there in Mongolia. And John Woods here has been attacked by black flies to the point where whatever he was wearing, they were biting right through it.
I was amused in something I read that you have been called by some a version of Indiana Jones, except you're now Illinois Kravitz.
Yeah, well, the Illinois Kravitz in the early part of this effort was attacked by a lot of different people, as well as by many other archaeologists in this world that were very unhappy that I, an uncredentialized man, is digging for such an important archaeological find.
You know, it is curious. If I remember the scenario of the first Indiana Jones film, Indiana Jones, in fact, got his PhD at the University of Chicago,
indeed.
Did he, Doctor?
That is correct.
In the anthropology department, I suppose.
Indeed he did, yes.
So it all lags together rather nicely. What can you tell us about modern Mongolia itself? What's the life like? What's the country like? It was for many years a Soviet dependency, wasn't it?
They've made a tremendous move in the last 15 years. They really went into Western world type of a society in 1990, after being under the Russian suzerainty for almost 74 years, and they have made incredible progress. You would not believe the activity and the business activity that's going on in Ulaanbaatar, the capital. And the government is very supportive, very democratic. Their elections are good and clean and without disturbances. They are very, very lenient and supportive of investment in Mongolia. They make it convenient and safe for people to invest. They've come a long way. They're very able people. There's only 2,400,000 of them in all of this vast country.
That's the total population?
That's the total population.
Just 2 million, 2.5 million.
Yes, 2.5 million people. That's it, Mel.
In a country twice the size of what, did you say?
Well, Texas.
Twice the size of Texas.
Yeah.
And about better than half the population is still pastoral and nomadic. Is that right?
Well, yeah, that's not exactly true. I mean, half the population lives in the capital, which tells you even more. Yeah. In the one city, basically. And it's about 57, almost 60% urban, the population. But the other urban centers are extremely small, and they're insignificant, really, in the total scheme of things. So it's a very, very curious situation. The people who live in the countryside still live
as they did thousands of years ago.
Exactly.
Years ago, when I was a graduate student at the University of Michigan, a young anthropologist, an anthropology professor, had been doing work out there and then joined the university faculty. And he told some of us of his contacts with, quote, the living Buddha of Ulaanbaatar, which refers then to their involvement in what is essentially Tibetan Buddhism.
They did get very involved. John can tell you more about that. But they have a very major segment of their history involved with Tibetan Buddhism.
Well, in fact, they become Tibetan Buddhists in the 16th century, and eventually a lama becomes the king of Mongolia. So he's the last king of Mongolia is, in fact, the living Buddha. And he is in power until he, well, until 1921. He dies in 1924. I'm not sure whether that's the person that...
No, he must have had a successor, but somebody
must
else
have had a successor.
Titled the living Buddha of Ulaanbaatar.
Right. But certainly the king of Mongolia, at the time Mongolia had a king, was in fact the living Buddha himself. And
do they remain Lamaist Tibetan Buddhists?
They did, despite the efforts of the Russian inspired Soviet inspired government to purge the religion there. They tried, but of course there's been a huge resurgence now with the decline and fall of communism in Mongolia, and people are recovering all of these Buddhist Tibetan Buddhist roots.
Sounds like a fascinating country to knock around in.
It's a wonderful country, and they're very wonderful people.
What's their national character like? How would you describe Mongolians?
I think that, how can I sum it up? I would say to you that having a Mongolian friend is having the best friend in the world.
Mm-hmm.
On the other side of it, don't have a Mongolian enemy. Not a good idea. So they're very honest. They have great integrity. They're fine people. Our relationship with our associates, our Mongolian professors, is the best. We're good friends. We hug and kiss, and we're the best of friends. I like the Mongolian people. I like the people in the street. I like the people you meet in business. Good people. I love Mongolia.
We must pause right now to do the usual round of commercials, then a quick newscast, and then we return. But before we stop for that, it is time to invite telephone calls. Anything you'd like to ask, or if there are other people, there must be rather few in our audience, who've actually traveled to Mongolia and want to talk about Mongolia, we'd be delighted to hear from you. Or are there, John, Mongolian graduate students around town?
Unfortunately, none that I know of. I mean, I think
there are lots of Chinese graduate
students. We'd like to have more, but at this point, no, there are not many.
At any rate, if you want to call us to raise a question or offer a thought, the number is, of course, as ever, 591-7200, 591-7200. If you're listening to us in Ulaanbaatar, or Ulaanbaatar is the way you say it properly, on the Internet, and you want to join the conversation, the best way is via email. The email address is extension720@tribune.com. The email is available to anybody who wants to reach us in that form, extension720, one word, at tribune, tribune.com. or 591-7200. We look forward to your contributions. Get them in now. We'll be with you shortly after these words. We will shortly be on to the telephones, and for that matter to the email, 591-7200, and for email, extension720@tribune.com. But a few more minutes directly with Maury Kravitz and John Woods, addressing, I would hope, this basic question. The Mongol Empire that we've talked about, the one that was launched by Genghis Khan and then extended by his descendants, really lasts for about 200 years. But as you've already indicated, to some degree the Mongols hold on and penetrate in a way the populations of other parts of the world, particularly in the Caucasus, I would gather, and in what are now the stands, former Soviet republics. This must also be true in China, where they ruled for quite a while.
And Iran.
And Iran itself, yes. The question I wanted to pose is, what persisted from and what lasts, not only in terms of genetic contributions, but in terms of culture, in terms of Weltanschauung, in terms of art, in terms of whatever, what persists of the Mongol invasion down to the present time?
Well, the first remarkable thing that persists, and it continues, and I don't know anybody that can explain how they have done it, but if somebody can explain to me, with all of my association with this country and its people, how 2.4 million people, squeezed on the top by the Russian Empire and buried from underneath by the Chinese, two of the largest countries in the world and the most powerful, and yet the Mongols retain their independence, yet the Mongols are truly Mongols, have not spilled over. To me, that's the modern miracle of Mongolia.
Mm-hmm.
But what has come down and what its greatest gift is as an empire He said the Mongolian Empire was the first true, real example of the opening of the East and the West. It was the Mongolian Empire that gave the East and the West the open door. That was their greatest contribution. Now, how do you, in one small question, you can't answer this, Milt. This is a monstrous gift to perhaps half the planet. And it was the Mongol Empire that did that.
What does come to mind, though, to return to a theme that I sounded at the very beginning, is the fact that they apparently did an awful lot of killing in the process. I'm sure we can't get an estimate of how many cities they wiped out, how many populations they destroyed, but it must be in the millions.
Well, I'm sure that's true. And one of the ironic things about the study of the Mongol Empire is in the places that they conquered, such as Russia and China and the Middle East, Iran namely, but other parts of the Middle East as well, they're in very bad odor, and they continue to be that way. It's only recently in, let's say, Russian historiography that there's been a different appreciation of Mongol rule. The same is true in China. I don't think it's really happened yet in Iran. But I think what Morey says is that culturally things happen that would not have been possible without what's been called the Pax Mongolica, but nonetheless this great openness of areas that had never been opened before. So in art, for example, in Iranian art, I can think of one example of Iranian historiography in which you have an Iranian writing the first real world history, which is as big a testimony to Mongolian cosmopolitanism than it is to anything else. He doesn't have any successors, unfortunately. But at least in that period,
his name was
Rashiduddin, and he was executed in 1318.
That far back.
Yes. So he did write the first world history in which he actually consulted representatives of Western Europe and India and China in order to create his narrative about things that had never been narrated before.
I want to try something trivial on you, but I can't resist. I'm very fond of so-called Indian cuisine. And as you well know, a major element in North Indian cuisine is tandoori cooking.
Yes, the clay oven.
The clay oven.
The chicken.
And that's part of the Mughal tradition in India.
Yeah.
Does that mean ultimately the tandoori oven derives from the steppes of Mongolia?
I don't think so. However, I'm going to tell you something. My favorite cuisine is Indian cooking.
Yeah.
If you put saag paneer in here or chicken tikka masala,
yeah,
I will have an enjoyable evening for myself.
So would I.
But I don't think you can give the Mongols credit for that cooking.
Most of those words are Persian, by the way. So the Iranians, but again, the cultural fusion that takes place under the people who found the Mughal Empire,
yeah,
is Turkish, Mongolian, and Persian. And they're the ones who take these traditions to India.
What did the Mongol conquest and the Mongol dominance that ran for two centuries in China, what did it leave in Chinese culture?
Well, certainly people have begun studying Yuan. Yuan is the name of the dynasty that the mm-hmm. Mongols found there. People have become very interested in Yuan painting now. They've become interested in Yuan poetry. So many of these things are just being examined in a different light right now because of sort of nationalist historical concerns.
Isn't it the case, John, that Marco Polo, as the Italian adventurer who penetrates into China, is in fact dealing with Mongol emperors?
Of course he is, definitely, and he is the one.
He's the Kublai Khan.
He visits Kublai
Khan. He's Italian for the Kublai Khan.
He's exactly the person that Maury's talking about who really opens the East to the West.
Exactly.
I mean, we eat spaghetti because of Marco Polo.
Yeah.
Trace that for me.
Well, because this is basically a Chinese food which is brought back to Europe and becomes now a European food.
And at the same time,
Italophiles must remember.
You can trace it all the way across.
Spaghetti comes from China.
At the same time, it's very interesting to take note that Kublai Khan, the grandson,
mm-hmm.
who gave birth to the Yuan dynasty, the only non-Chinese dynasty in the entire dynastic history of China, was one of a Mongol dynasty, the Yuan dynasty. But he looked across the water, across the Sea of Japan,
yeah,
and said, I want Japan. I want to invade Japan. The interesting part of that is that he did mount a tremendous invasion of Japan with Korean ships, and the entire Mongol invasion force was destroyed by a storm. The storm was called Kamikaze by the Japanese,
uh-huh.
the Divine Wind, which is what they named their suicide pilots
yes,
in
indeed.
The Second World War, the Kamikaze mm-hmm. pilots.
Fascinating stuff. and you are fascinating our listeners. We're going to pause right now, get some commercials properly processed, and then on to the phones. There are a few lines available. For a while, they were all taken, but now I see one or two are available again. The number is 591-7200. Get your calls in quickly, and we'll get directly to them after the impending commercials. If you'd rather reach us by email, that address is extension720@tribune.com. Quick reintroduction of our guests, and we go directly to the phones and to the email. Those guests are Maury Kravitz, Chicago lawyer, and you're still active in the Commodities Exchange, aren't you?
Yes, I am.
Or the Merck, rather.
Yes.
Who is the leader of the Genghis Khan expedition dedicated to finding the tomb of Genghis Khan. And John Woods, who is, he's got a distinguished and rather long academic title, professor of Iranian and Central Asian history and Near Eastern languages and civilizations, and former director of the Center for Middle Eastern Studies at the University of Chicago, who is the academic advisor and the active participant as academic advisor to the same Genghis Khan expedition. 591-7200 is our number. And gentlemen, here's the first caller. Good evening.
Good evening, Milt.
Yes, sir.
Good evening, gentlemen. I had a question for you. Concerning the tomb of Genghis Khan, is there any local lore, anything surrounding it as to, like, magical powers or curses or anything that would fall upon, much like with the tombs in Egypt and the pyramids, with anyone who would find it or encroach upon it?
Let me try to answer that. I don't think that you have a set of curses that go with the hunt for the Genghis Khan tomb. However, let me say this, that I've just been reading recently that there is a set of opinions that are coming out that some of the world's greatest catastrophes are the result of attempts to disturb the resting place of the Khan. The tsunami recently, there were some opinions that they resulted from disturbances to Genghis Khan's rest.
Wow.
But, you know, the Egyptian curses were much more specific.
Right, right.
You know.
Mongol rulers were generally buried inside an area that was called Kuruk, which means a forbidden area.
Okay.
So there were notions about the inviolability of certain areas. And one of the problems that our expeditions run into is the shamanistic notion that if you could destroy the spirit of a person by destroying their material remains. So that's a very charged kind of issue, and it's one that we've had to face.
Okay, now we're also with that of destruction of the spirit on servants. Do you have any issues with any of the locals bothering you who are afraid that you would disturb the spirit?
Yes, of course. We've had difficulties over time, and at a certain point, Maury and I even discussed commissioning a public opinion poll to see what people generally thought about our doing it. But and it sort of shakes out in an interesting way. The intellectuals and the scientists generally tend to side with us, that this is a very worthwhile kind of thing. I mean,
right.
I think they think that scientifically it's important, and I think
right.
Other people see that it could also mean good things for Mongolia in terms of tourism and things of that sort. So
right.
certain kinds of people are for this, certain other kinds of people are against it, and I haven't quite exactly figured out what distinguishes one from the other. But as I can say, generally speaking, the professors and the intellectuals and government folks and business people seem to support us.
Okay. Also, is there any way that one could follow along? Like, do you have a website or anything where you post reports on the progress of the search or anything?
Yeah, we have just put together a website, and you know, I'm trying to think of what the website name is. I think it's GenghisKhan.com.
Okay.
And we invite you to consult with that, because we're going to constantly update it with
okay.
what's going on.
All right. Well, gentlemen, I appreciate it.
Thank
you
for
my call.
Thank you,
much.
Sir, for the call. And again, the number 591-7200. One or two lines are available at this instant. If you've been trying to reach us, try again, and somebody will get through. 591-7200, you are on the air. Good evening.
Good evening.
Yes, sir.
It seems like it's a tremendously expensive undertaking to partake in the expedition. I was wondering, how did you fund the expedition, or how do you fund the exposition, and do you accept private investors, say, like shares of stock?
Well, we have funded it up to this date by private investors who have given a certain amount of money, each of them, to fund our years in the field. We have not gone to corporations for corporate grants.
Have you not gone to foundations?
We have not gone to foundations. It's a long, arduous process. We're much more direct. When we go to the field, we need our cash. And expense is always related to how involved the digging is. Let me give you a sense of it so I can answer the question cogently. If we're to dig in one place with one digging crew, that's with archaeologists, support people, enough food in the field, and fuel for our vehicles, and living out in the Mongolian wilds for 2 months, June 15th to August 15th, that's going to cost us about $150,000. If we're going to put two teams in the field, we would need about $200,000, $210,000, and three teams in the field, we need $300,000 or $275,000 to $300,000 every summer. Believe it or not, when we started out, we thought it would be a lot more. We think that these numbers, we've gotten them down to a reasonable amount.
Are you restricted only to June and July? What's the weather like in the rest of the year?
The weather's a problem because even in July, you start getting into the rainy season. And a part of it's dependent on my teaching schedule. Unfortunately, I have to teach until the middle of June, so I'm not really free before then. It doesn't mean that the expedition couldn't start earlier. And in one case, that probably would have been very suitable to do that. But by the time you're getting into August, it's starting to get chilly at night. And there's a saying in Mongolia that is, fall begins with Nadam. Nadam is the great national festival that takes place the first part of July. So already in August, people are starting to gather fodder for the animals for the winter and things of that sort. So
Mongolia is pretty high up, isn't it?
It's generally anywhere from 5 where we operate. Yeah. It'll be between 4,500 and 6,500 square feet, approximately.
Above sea level.
Above sea level, yeah.
And just mentioning it as we passed, John talked about the storms. I personally never saw horizontal rain until I got to Mongolia.
Mm-hmm.
And the rains and the storms there are something to behold. It's not nice to be involved with.
The weather's very violent.
Mm-hmm. Our thanks to that caller. Let's go quickly to another on 591. 7200. Good evening.
Hi. My original question was about the movie, The Story of the Weeping Camel, if the gentleman had seen that and whether that was a good depiction of Mongolia. But I do have a quick point of information. There were two other dynasties that were not Chinese, Northern Song and the Qing Dynasty, the Manchu Dynasty.
Yes, there were other non-Chinese dynasties.
Yeah. And what the movie, which was, you know, beautiful cinematographically, I'm not sure whether it was a typical representation of a Mongolian family, but it did raise some questions in my mind. I was trying to find where they were, and it said, you know.
Well, I gather, John, you know that movie rather well, do you?
Yes, that movie was filmed in one of the southern provinces of Mongolia, in one of the Gobi provinces, which is far away from where we work normally. So I can't speak exactly about that particular situation. But it rang absolutely true in the sense, I don't know whether you had the same feeling when you saw the movie or not, but what I felt when I watched the movie was the intense connection of human beings and nature. And that's something that you cannot help but feel in Mongolia.
And it was from Mongolia proper. I mean, that was the impression I got.
Oh, yes, absolutely. It was not Inner Mongolia. In other words, it was not China or some other area. It was one of the southern Aymogs or southern provinces of Mongolia.
By the way, what's the distinction between Inner Mongolia and Outer Mongolia?
Well, that distinction is not been to my liking, but it has been used over a number of years.
The country you've been working in is what used to be called Outer Mongolia, is that right?
Well, yes, and the Inner Mongolia is really a part of China.
Yeah.
It has a Mongolian population, a significant one, mm-hmm. and the Chinese have given it the name the Autonomous Mongolian People's Republic. but it's part of China. It's around the Chinese borders. It's administrated by China. There are a lot of Mongols. A couple million of them are living in there.
Absolutely. I think there are more Mongolians in Inner Mongolia than in Mongolia proper. So these terms, inner and outer, are obviously all from the Chinese perspective. And if you say Outer Mongolia, Mongolians get sort of upset because of the Chinese reference there.
I was remembering, and I was asking you about this during, I guess, the last commercial break, that the last Soviet ambassador to Mongolia was none other than Vyacheslav Molotov, the former foreign minister and Stalin's intimate, when he was already in disgrace. But instead of killing him, Brezhnev sent him to be ambassador.
He'd been relegated to Mongolia, yes, Mongolia. Because that was an area that had not been annexed, of course, by the Soviet Union, for all kinds of reasons. Interesting reasons, by the way. We go into those. But interesting reasons, was not annexed, did not become a republic of the Soviet Union. And that was a place where you sent people like that.
Yeah. We go back, I think before we go back to the phones, and there are some lines available, 591-7200, let me read you one or two emails. Here is the one I was looking for. This fellow says, as much as you might like, he says, he addresses this to me, as much as you might like to get a scoop on the location, please lay off. Given the history, current, and past of what happens to historic sites whose locations become known and the looting that follows, please lay off. But what a wonderful guest, what a wonderful quest they're sharing with you. Bravo. I think he's telling me, don't press them on the location. But you've already, in essence, identified the location with regard to mountain with the...
And there are a number of tourists who come and visit us there now, who come to the site, and we would like to have even more people to be able to come there. And our Mongolian colleagues would like to have even more than we would like to have. Nonetheless, the site is protected, and we do pay for... a watchman there, and it is seen to. So I don't think there's too much chance right now of that site.
But if I went to Mongolia, I could find somebody to guide me to and take me to Og Lakchin Kerem.
You probably could, yes.
Probably, yes.
You probably could.
But what you have not identified is just where in that space and area.
That is correct.
The tomb might be located.
That is correct.
Do you have your own hypotheses about that? Do you know where to dig next?
No, we feel our way through.
I know where I want to dig next, but that's just me. And I'm not going to tell you. So.
No, you should not tell me. I might rush over there and beat you to the punch, obviously. 591-7200, our number. Here is our next caller. Good evening.
Good evening.
Yes, ma'am.
I was on my way home from work, so I missed part of your program, but when you were talking about Mongolia, I'm going to be headed there in May. My daughter has lived there since the 1st of June 2003. She's in the Peace Corps.
Mm-hmm.
She lives in the village of Bayandalay, which is in the Gobi Desert.
Now, what is she doing as a Peace Corps worker there?
She teaches English in a secondary school.
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
She lives in a ghare. She has her own ghare, which is made out of felt. She has electricity, but she doesn't have any plumbing or any other amenities. She lives all by herself. She's the only English-speaking person in the town. And she'll be there until June. And I'm going to go see her with her students.
Well, you mentioned she lives in a ghare. What is a ghare?
A ghare is the round house that the nomads live in that can be disassembled as they move around. And these are all herder children that attend the school. They stay there all year. And then when school is out, then they join their families wherever they're moving around the country. So, with this ghare, there wasn't really a whole lot of choice of where she could be living. And so she found this place to live. And she's very self-sufficient. She has a little stove for heat. And right now, I was checking the internet. It was 26 below in Ulaanbaatar. And so, you know, it's probably even colder because there isn't a tree around. It's just flat nothingness. But she loves it. She's enjoying herself while she's there and finishing it out.
How long is she assigned to stay there?
Well, she is going to be there till the end of June.
Mm-hmm.
So now is the really harshest. And when you were talking before about it being cold after Nottam, it was starting to get cold. they had snow in October already.
Gee, Maury, you could, if she's finishing in June, you could recruit her onto your archaeological team.
Sure.
If she wants to grab a shovel and dig in, we'll make her welcome.
I will say that Gers are actually very warm in the winter. I was there in November once, and it was extremely cold when I was there. It wasn't the dead of winter as it is now, but it was very cold.
Sure.
And it was warm as toast inside that Ger. And we stay in Gers the whole time we're there also.
You
so.
Do.
Yeah, by the way, did your daughter say tell you how she warms her stove?
No.
Oh, my goodness. You'll find that very interesting.
Oh, okay. I mean, what she's using for fuel.
Yes.
Oh, yes.
Yes.
Well, we know all about that.
Okay.
She was,
all right.
Instigated a fuel market. She got a grant from the government, and they created a little co-op in her village, thanks to her, so that people could bring all of their extra fuel, whatever it the source was, and be redistributed. So I know all about that.
That's marvelous.
Yeah.
Good.
So I was just making my plans today, as a matter of fact, for my trip to Mongolia, and I'm going to be there for 3 weeks.
I hope you'll be there for Nadam.
No, I'll be there at May 13th. I'm leaving, but I want to spend a few days in Beijing on the way and one on the way back to kind of break up the trip. And so,
if you find the tomb of Genghis Khan by accident, be in touch.
Okay, I'll let you know.
All right, thank you for the call.
Right.
The fuel, I gather, is organic.
Yes, it is, indeed.
We are going to pause for a quick round of commercials and then directly back on 591-7200 and for email, extension 720 at tribune.com. And directly back to Maury Gravitz and John Woods, the two main men on the great expedition to locate and excavate, I guess, the tomb of Genghis Khan. If you do find it, in fact, what would you do with the materials you find therein?
Those materials would...
They all are turned over to the government.
Absolutely, directly to the government and as quickly as possible.
But if you found a body, the remains of a body that you were pretty sure was Genghis Khan, what would you do with that?
Well, I would not disturb it right away. If we were sure that that body, that discovery, was the old man himself, was Genghis Khan himself, I think we would close it up immediately and wait for government response. Couldn't get near it. I would not touch it. I wouldn't have any of our people touch it.
But you could take a DNA sample to determine just how many of in the broad population of various sectors of the empire descend from that line.
Clearly, that would be one of the goals of people who would be following our discoveries. But that would, as Maury says, I think we would have to wait until the government gave us permission to do anything with any of the things that we found.
We go back to the phones on 591-7200. You are on the air. Good evening.
Yes, I was just wondering whether they might know what among and the Khazar peoples or empire was. To what extent is a relation or Mongol inclusion in the Confederation?
Now, the Khazars are of special interest because for a while there was a major hypothesis around that the Ashkenazic Jews of Eastern Europe were descended from the Khazars, who we do know were converted to Judaism in what? Is it the 8th century or thereabouts?
Yes, thereabouts.
Yeah, and that is memorialized in a famous book, the Kitab al-Khazari of Yehuda ben Levi.
Yes. So I guess what your question is what is the relationship between Mongols and Turks? And that's an issue that's still discussed a great deal, and we're not exactly sure. Generally speaking, it's...
You count the Khazars as a Turkish people?
If they, in fact, they are. I mean,
Turkmen people.
The general feeling is that they are descendants of the breakup of the great Turkish Empire of Central Asia from the 6th to the 8th century. Mm-hmm. That when that empire broke up, then people like the Khazars and the Turkmen and other people... Uyghurs went off to different areas. And the question there is, what is the relationship between Turks and Mongols? And there is something called the Altaic linguistic theory that suggests that Turkish and Mongol and Tunguz or Manchu are all somehow related. Well, I always like to tell the story about our visit to a Turkish archaeological site in Mongolia, and I was teasing my Turkish friends. I said, of course, I mean, since you speak this related language, you have no problem understanding your Mongolian colleagues. Well, they can't understand a word because the similarities are not at all of the same nature as, let's say, similarities between other languages that we think of as being related, like numerals, like kinship terms and so on. So the whole question of relationship of languages in that part of the world is not the same as what we think of as in the West, and therefore relationship of peoples is a little bit more complicated.
Well, the Khazars allegedly moved into Eastern Europe around the 9th century.
Yes.
There was 300 years before a Mongolian state was came into existence as such, as a national entity. 8th century, that period, the Khazar period, was centered between the time of the Huns and the later 340 years, the Mongol period.
By the way, with regard to the Khazars, I've mentioned that hypothesis much elaborated by Arthur Koestler in his book, The 13th Tribe,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
That modern East European Jews are descended from the Khazars. That's been pretty much rejected by scholars.
Yes, I think that the general feeling now is that if we talk about the Judaism of the Khazars, we're talking about the fact that probably the elites, the ruling elite and the administrative elite, were the converts, and it didn't really spread to the entire population. Mm-hmm. That seems pretty much outdated. I understand that DNA evidence also shows that probably there's no relationship.
Here's a curious email that has come in. What about the curse that was allegedly attached to the opening of Tamerlane's tomb? We haven't yet said who Tamerlane was. Which curse was supposed to bring on the German attack and World War II? Does he understand that?
No, I'm going to let John answer that. But before he does, I would like your audience might get a kick in the idea. And, John, I don't think I'm pre-announcing this, but my dear and beloved friend John Woods has already been commissioned to write a book on the life of Tamerlane by a very significant publishing entity. So nobody can answer questions about Tamerlane better than this gentleman next to me.
Let's be clear who Tamerlane is. He's, in a way, a successor, is he not?
Yes, he was in many ways, although he was not descended directly from Genghis Khan. He claimed a common ancestry with Genghis Khan, if that's clear. I mean, he was not directly in the line, but he was a branch of the...
He is a Mongol.
Yes, as is often said, he was a Turkicized Mongol, but he spoke himself Turkish and Mongol and Persian. And he saw himself very much in the mold of Genghis Khan, and he was a conqueror in a similar fashion that Genghis Khan was.
About 200 years later, or is it?
About 100 years later.
100 years later.
About 100 years later. So the email writer is referring to a curse that was current in Samarkand, where Tamerlane is buried, where Timur is buried, that said that the person who disturbed Timur's remains would unleash the source of terrible war. And that was particularly important. It was announced in a number of Soviet newspapers just as a Soviet team was about to open Tamerlane's tomb. And they did, and 2 days later, the Nazis invaded the Soviet Union.
That's correct.
Was it really Tamerlane's tomb? Do we have?
It was indeed. I mean,
was that verified?
Oh, yes, yes. It definitely was Tamerlane's tomb. The skeleton that they found was lame, was missing fingers from one hand, had tuberculosis.
Where is that tomb located?
In Samarkand.
Samarkand.
Yes.
Yes. Christopher Marlowe does a great play about Tamerlane the Conqueror.
Edgar Allan Poe has a poem called Tamerlane, yeah. And so on and so on. Handel has an opera called Tamerlano.
Exactly. And we have a last round of commercials. Now waiting, we'll take care of those and then directly back. There are now a number of lines available. If you've been trying to reach us on 591-7200, do try again. We'll be with you in about 3 minutes. And speaking of our audio archive, I hereby predict that this program tonight will wind up on the audio archive. Might take a few weeks before it goes up. We get them up usually on Fridays. One program went up last Friday, two or three more will be up this Friday. And there are literally dozens, close to 100 full two-hour programs available on the audio archive, and excerpts from still many more. You get there, indeed, as you just heard in the announcement, by going to WGNradio.com, and then on the front page, click on My Name. And that takes you to the subsite for Extension 720, where you find the audio archive and also our monthly program guide, and Milt's File, which is now done about twice a week, in which we put out put up links to all sorts of interesting things that I have ferreted out in the international press, from scholarly sources and yet other stranger sources, for your delectation and edification. 591-7200 is our number. Before we go back to the phones, an interesting email I read. Isn't it likely that Genghis Khan's tomb, if it ever existed, has been looted? What convinces you that Khan's tomb has escaped the fate of almost all other burial sites of the ancient and medieval world?
Well, I think that would be a very easy question to answer. If it had been looted, if it had the contents I think would be present there, the loot and pillage of these great cities and great cultures, some of this loot would have reappeared in some form and some basis of identification. The reason that we feel that the tomb has not been found is one of the very reasons is that not any of these artifacts that could be associated with the conquest has ever appeared by any private person or any museum or any demonstrative agency. This tells us that the tomb is lies intact and untouched.
I find that to be a credible argument. I don't always agree with Maury on everything, but I think that this is a very interesting approach and a very interesting way of looking at things. As I said before, we've never found any Imperial Mongol tombs to know exactly what we're looking for. We have some references from that same Rashid ad-Din, that 14th century Persian historian that I mentioned before, who talks about Genghis Khan's grandson and his great-grandson, who were buried in Iran. And he says that they were the last rulers to be buried in accordance with Mongolian tradition, which means they were buried with arms, with booty, and with the sacrifice of young women. So that gives us some...
The sacrifice of young women.
The sacrifice of young
Explain.
Women. Well, women were sacrificed, young women were sacrificed at the time that these burials took place. One of the interesting things, and one of the fascinating and intriguing things we found in the course of our excavations at the Ugluk Chinkerem was the skull of a young female in association with one of the what we think are ritual areas that we examined. It was not a burial because it was not a complete skeleton, but it was a skull and two long bones, possibly the humerus or the femur. I'm not sure exactly. But nonetheless, it suggests that this was a sacrificial, an example of human sacrifice in association.
Are these young women sent along in sacrificial form to serve as concubines in the afterlife?
I suppose that that's the ritual purpose, yes.
Yeah. Also, I read that it is assumed, or it's somehow, it's in the mythology at least, or in the lore, that some 50 soldiers who buried Genghis Khan were then immediately executed, and then the 50 who executed them commit suicide. What does that story make any sense?
Now, that's a little different of the story that's the accepted story. The story that comes down is that there were 2,000 members of the burial party.
Hmm.
They were conducted into the field by 400 soldiers. When they had done the interment, the 2,000 were all killed by the 400.
What would the logic be for that?
The logic would be that when the 400 came back, before they got back to the imperial capital, but when they were in sight of the capital, a large tumult of 1,000 soldiers met them, and they were killed. And as a proof of that it was a thorough job, 400 pairs of ears were presented to the Khan, then in residence.
These don't really sound like the sort of people one would like to spend a Saturday night at the bar with.
No, the 50-50 story is also borne out by a site that's near the site that we're working at right now. It's called the Tomb of the 100 Soldiers. And the notion is there that 50 were detailed to bury the Khan, and 50 more killed them, and that 50 were killed. So this area is called the Tomb of the 100 Soldiers, and that's within 25 miles of where we're working right now. So that was one of the things that intrigued me. It's folklore, of course. The point still remains that about the burial itself, the only near contemporary testimony we have is from the Secret History of the Mongols. And the Secret History of the Mongols says that Genghis Khan died. That's all it says. It does not say anything more. All these other things are poetry. And they come from China. They come from Iran. They come locally. But it's
doesn't it say that he died in battle?
That's not even clear entirely.
It's not clear. It's
not clear.
The best that we could garner together is that he was on a punitive mission punishing the Tungut peoples of northern China, that province. He fell from his horse. He was severely injured, in great pain, developed a fever and died, and then was carted back to Mongolia. But just tonight, I mentioned to John, another archival piece came into my possession by a writer, and I'm sending it to him so he can look it over, that says, Genghis Khan was in the Tangut on a punitive mission. He fell off his horse. He couldn't get up for a couple of days, but then he did. The fever he had passed. He got up, rode back to Mongolia, and then died. So here you got a completely other little story. Our clues are not very good ones. I think the boys in the Valley of the Kings in Egypt there have a lot easier time than we have.
The Secret History of the Mongols, of which we've mentioned a few times, what do we know about its authorship?
We don't know that much, actually. It's probably written by several authors.
It's written, it appears only 20 years or so after
Genghis's
death.
Yes, it appears about 13 years after his death.
13 years is right.
Really, it's really quite approximate in terms of time. The only way we have this, however, is in Mongolian, but written in Chinese characters. So you have a really complicated text that many people spend their whole lives just studying that text.
By the way, I read, Maury, that you have been studying Mongolian.
Yes.
How well do you do with it by now?
I'm trying to get conversational in it, and I have a lovely Mongolian teacher, a lady that lives here in Chicago.
Really?
The wife of a peace worker, by the way, an American peace team worker. And both John and I are now going to continue with lessons on Saturdays or what's ever convenient for the two of us.
I would fain hear some brief discourse between you twain in Mongol.
Sahim Bano.
You can say Sahim Bano, which is the normal greeting.
Now give me a little more than that. Talk to one another.
No, we're not ready for it.
Can't do it?
We're ready for that.
Not ready for it.
All right. We'll go back to the phones instead. On 591-7200. Good evening.
Yeah, on C-SPAN 2's book TV, Public Life, not too long ago, there is a guy, and I can't remember his name, but he did a biography on Genghis Khan, and I think the title is called Genghis Khan, The Making of the Modern World. I was wondering if your guests could comment on that, and if they could compare Genghis Khan to any modern Asian leader like Mao Zedong or Ho Chi Minh or anyone like that. I'll hang up and listen to your answer after I get off the phone.
It's a deal. Thank you, sir, for the call.
Terrific. You're talking about Genghis Khan and the Making of the Modern World by Jack Weatherford of McAllister College. He's an anthropologist there, and it's a book that Maury and I have often said that we think we should have written. It's a very interesting expansion on the notion of what's sometimes called the Pax Mongolica. That's P-A-X, not P-O-X. Pax Mongolica, the Mongol peace. And in some ways, you know, Genghis Khan was declared by the Washington Post in, was it 1995, Maury?
Yes.
As the man of the millennium in terms of his accomplishments. And I'd like to go back to something that Maury said earlier, that he is the person who really opens up, who really establishes for the first time in human history the connection between the civilizations of China and Central Asia and the Middle East and European culture. So it creates a situation in which there is a real, what's sometimes been called, a real world system, a world economic and cultural system in which ideas and money and products and so on flowed throughout this whole area. So I think there is some reason to call him that. Would you agree, Maury?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
To compare him to people like Mao Zedong and Ho Chi Minh, I mean, we're talking about someone who's operating on a much vaster scale and involving, in the case of both those leaders, they're popular leaders of their own people. Here you're talking about a person who not only unites his own people, but also unites many other people in this great, not to be anachronistic, but multinational undertaking.
But, pardon me for persisting with the theme, at what cost? And, you know, I think of the great sonnet, Ozymandias, and the line in it, look upon my works ye mighty and despair, and around him all about the desert lies, and so on. I mean, nothing lasts. So empires of this sort, from Alexander to Genghis Khan to Tamerlane and others we could mention, even up to Napoleon, they all collapse, don't they?
Every one of them. And I'm sure that the ones in the future will follow the same course.
How can you say that if we still use a Napoleonic cone in Louisiana? I mean, come on. I mean, they don't all collapse. Alexander's empire collapsed very rapidly, but in the case of the Mongol Empire, it lasts longer. What about the Roman Empire? Its influence lasts a lot longer. It depends on how you.
Well, everything that happens, John, has historic consequences.
Yes, and you measure the persistence of something a lot longer. It's not simply who's ruling and whether or not there's a king who calls himself Mongol ruler or a Roman emperor.
Of course, the Romans did a lot of very cruel murder also, didn't
they? They did, and people do that when they conquer things. I'm not trying to blow this off by saying that conquest brings death and destruction. And it's true. You do have to make a historical judgment at some point. At what cost does this take place?
I do want to assess this as saying the cost of the Mongol conquest was somehow worth it in terms of the payoff.
I think when you sum up all of the things that Genghis Khan brought to the table, the balance on the scale is going to weigh heavily in his favor. And it's not to say, I'm not trying to make a Dr. Schweitzer out of him. He was a conqueror. He took a sword in his hand. He knew what he was doing. He knew what he was about. And he knew the condition of the world that he lived in.
How do you react to the fact that in one great Hollywood film, great in quotes, he is portrayed by, of all people, John Wayne.
Yeah, which, by the way, I must tell you, I'm going to sum that up with one little observation.
Yeah.
That movie with John Wayne probably represents the worst movie ever made in the history of Hollywood.
It's often put on into that category, in fact.
Yeah.
Well, it's also very strange that all the people who participated in then died of cancer shortly thereafter.
Is that so?
One of the callers or one of the people questioners earlier talked about a curse of Genghis Khan. Well, I mean, that might have been the curse of Genghis Khan trying to represent him. There was also a film about Genghis Khan starring Omar Sharif as Genghis Khan as well. So that wasn't quite so bad, but it was also pretty bad.
Bad, very bad, but not as bad as John Wayne.
No, John Wayne was horrible.
Can you imagine a proper film on Genghis Khan? Has any such been done?
There was a Chinese version made, which was pretty good, and I saw it in a very poor copy of it. But I think a real great Genghis Khan movie has yet to be made.
And I think people in Mongolia would like to make it now. Filmmakers there would like to make this film.
We are going to wind down in just a moment. I do want to make very clear once again that our guests have been Maury Kravitz and John Woods, who are the two leading people in the great expedition searching for the tomb of Genghis Khan, or Chinggis Khan, I should be saying. Maury Kravitz is a well-established Chicago lawyer and a businessman, and John Woods is an old colleague from the University of Chicago, where he is professor of Iranian and Central Asian history and Near Eastern languages, former director of the Center for Middle Eastern Studies. And with that, there's time left only to thank you, gentlemen, both for joining us.